Welcome to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The 2018 Iowa legislative session wrapped up on Saturday. It's 2 weeks overdue, and this was another historic year for Republican lawmakers who control the House, the Senate, and the governor's office as well. They passed a major tax overhaul, an abortion bill that is the strictest in the nation, and more. And with me here to talk about the session and give their analysis are four Siouxland area lawmakers. Democrat Chris Hall of Sioux City represents the 13th House District.
Hello.
Jim Carlin of Sioux City is a Republican. And now, Jim, you represent, is it the 3rd Senate District?
Yes, it is, Mary.
And you were in the 6th House seat, and now Jacob Bossman, who is here, has your old seat.
He does.
Glad to be here.
Doing a marvelous job, too.
All right. And also here is the only independent in the state house. I'm sorry, the state senate. Pardon me. In either house, David Johnson. And we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And Tim Cassina as well from Sioux City.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And you're from Osceola.
I'm from Osceola County.
Osceola County. Ocheyedan.
The proud town of Ocheyedan.
Right, okay.
Home of the Mound.
Home of the Mound, all right. Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start with kind of a general question about legislative session and go around and kind of give your impressions of, you know, who are the winners and who are the losers, or however you want to phrase it. What's your take on this session, Chris Hall?
I would say the last, you know, this legislative session as well as last year, probably, you know, this is my 8th year in the legislature, and those two combined are by far the most partisan of the legislative sessions that I've seen. I think that several big issues were taken up. They are certainly consequential, but I also think that they are consequential in a way that many Iowans would disagree with. If you look at collective bargaining, the absolute mess of a budget that we are dealing with right now, and the fact that it's going to continue to be a messy budget for years to come because of short-sighted tax policy that was passed, I think that many Iowans are right to be frustrated. We've been underfunding public education for several years straight in order to kind of stifle off all these funds and make them available for a tax cut. And truthfully, my point of view on it is that this is the wrong time to do so. If the state's economy is ranked 43 out of 50 states nationally, if Governor Reynolds was forced to borrow $140 million out of our reserves, the state surplus is in question because of Medicaid negotiations that are still ongoing. There are all these big question marks that have a real financial impact that are tied to them. And right now, it seemed that the Republican legislature felt it was more important to make campaign promises than to make the math work. So I think that it was very short-sighted and something that we're going to have to end up dealing with for years to come.
Okay. Jim Carlin.
I guess my take on it is, you know, Republican speeches, the stump speeches you typically hear, are, you know, center on two things, tax reform and life. And this truly was a year where both of those were addressed. Iowans know that we have some of the highest tax rates in the country, and that's why we're just not competitive. And, you know, when you want to talk about ranking low economically, well, we're U.S. News and World Report says we're probably the best state in the country to live in. We're also considered, when it comes to our fiscal management, one of the best managed states. And so, you know, we had to look at how do we get more competitive. And, you know, while Democrats like to talk about how poor people are suffer when you have things like tax cuts, when you exploit the pain of people, when it doesn't really take them any place, just so it gets you elected and doesn't really help those people. Those are concerns, you know. But Iowans are going to see more money in their pockets. Iowa families are going to see a 7 to 10% tax cut that's going to benefit them. And, you know, we believe that, you know, when corporations take a look at Iowa after this tax reform bill comes into play and it starts to get noticed, it's going to attract more businesses to the state, which, you know, will create jobs and more revenue for the state coffers to pay our bills. So we're very enthusiastic about
that. Well, I think it was very popular with some people in this area because of all the business that goes to up to South Dakota and Nebraska. That was an issue for especially businesses.
Huge issue for us.
As some others, though, were not in favor, but... I guess I'll go to Jacob Osman. Yeah, now, this is your first year.
It is, and I came in the middle of session, hit the ground running, but learned a lot and was honored to be a part of a lot of these conversations. But I just wanted to piggyback on your point that, just, was it 3 months ago when I was knocking on doors campaigning in Morningside, by far the main issue that I heard from people, and I actually beyond just ideological points, I heard a few different specific people tell me that they were actively looking for houses in the dunes or were planning to move to South Dakota as soon as they or their wife retired. And so I think the real winners of this session were the taxpayers of Northwest Iowa. When you do tax reform, a lot has been talked about putting money back in residents' pockets, but I think the bigger issue for us up here in Northwest Iowa is being competitive with South Dakota. And I do believe once this is fully implemented in a responsible way where we have the guardrails, the triggers that have to be met before as early as 2023, the top rate can be, I believe the rates would go down to 4.4, 5.5, and 6.5. That I think that makes us much more competitive with South Dakota. You hear a lot about businesses and people moving from Iowa to South Dakota. You don't hear near as much about people from Nebraska moving to South Dakota because Nebraska's at 6.8 and it's close enough. I think a lot of people don't realize it takes some effort and money to move your business or yourself to South Dakota. And I think if we can get that top rate down to 6.5, it takes away a lot of that impetus where I think a lot of our people and our businesses will stay here because we have so much more to offer in Sioux City. The workforce is here and a lot of the amenities are here that we can compete at 6.5, I believe. And so I think this is huge for the people of Northwest Iowa and particularly Sioux City.
David Johnson, you're the independent here. We have two Democrats and two Republicans. So what do you think?
Well, in a big, broad stroke, I would say the big loser was rural Iowa. And the reasons for that is we've driven good-paying jobs. We will be driving good-paying jobs, middle-class jobs, out of rural Iowa. That would include teachers, any public workers. I voted against the gutting of our collective bargaining law, which had been working very well. I saw no reason to be changing something that the proponents were arguing that we had to put the taxpayer at the bargaining table. I just wonder how many taxpayers ended up in negotiations. I don't think too many. And education, we continue to underfund schools. We're going to have another round of school consolidations in the not-too-distant future. That's going to have to be a local decision, not a state decision. Health care, our hospitals already in Northwest Iowa. I represent 5 counties. I would say that every hospital, major hospital in those 5 counties is suffering from the change of our Medicaid program to managed care organizations. They were the winners. Mm-hmm. They came out pretty good here because we're going to continue to do that, and which is absolutely, I've been opposed from the very beginning. And I really mean this seriously. The winner, the big winner here are any fans out there for President Calvin Coolidge. We've been the Coolidgeites have been arguing ever since the late 20s that all we have to do is change our tax laws, make ourselves more competitive for business. Remember, he's the president who said the business of America is business. And it doesn't work. I've been in there 20 years. I haven't seen it work yet, and that's one reason I voted against the tax cuts. It's irresponsible fiscal planning.
What about Hoover? Would he say that too, do you think?
Hoover, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so.
Yeah, he was more of an interventionist.
He was a very, in many ways, he brought us the 8-hour workday, 40-hour work week. I mean, in many ways, Hoover was much more of a progressive than Calvin Coolidge was. He just wasn't prepared for the Great Depression. He couldn't pull us out of it.
Right. Well, Tim Kasina, you can tell us what you think of Coolidge, or you can tell us about the legislative session.
I think as far as winners and losers, I think really the people of Iowa lost.
because just for the fact that there was not going to be a bill come up in legislature that they didn't already have 51 votes for. So it took out any negotiations from one side or the other or any type of bipartisanship that would happen within the legislature. So honestly, without having a representative government that we deserve, we did not get that this year. We got a dictative government. On the other part, I'd just like to touch on South Dakota and how they always throw out how if we had the same taxes as South Dakota. But what they never say is, in South Dakota, that is the number two state in the country that has gambling revenue. Now, do we really want to become a state to bring in our revenue so we can keep our taxes down by doing what they do? I don't think so.
Republicans, do you have anything to say to that? Don't have to, but...
Well, Tim, I guess what in terms of the total amount of revenue that gambling brings into the state of South Dakota, what percentage would that be, do you know?
Not right off hand.
Okay.
And I would say we don't want to become South Dakota. I mean, there's a lot of differences, but I do think we need to understand and accept the fact that there are going to be businesses and people moving, you know, to a place mm-hmm. where there are lower taxes. And I don't think anybody, I definitely am not saying we need to strive to get to zero income tax, because I do think that Sioux City has things out. When you talk about businesses, the supply chain, the workers are here. It's a little bit of a hit for them to move to South Dakota and convince their customers to go over there. But I don't, so I think that we can keep businesses and people in Sioux City if we're at least close. You know, and I think even just now our corporate tax rate is going to be the second highest in the country instead of the highest. That's a step in the right direction. The personal income tax rate at 6.5%, I think will stop a lot of the bleeding. I think over the next 10, 20 years, you will see a lot of the, you know, the United Commercial Real Estate, the Hendricks, Connor, Williams, the companies that have moved probably won't move back, but you probably will stop seeing that continue mm-hmm. to happen. Mm-hmm. So I, regardless of where, whether it's you know, property taxes or sales tax or gambling revenue in South Dakota, I'm not saying that we should be like South Dakota, but we do need to accept the fact that they have an unfair advantage, or they have an advantage over us, and we need to do whatever we can to combat that.
You know, I was going to ask
sure.
Chris, because mm-hmm. We have talked before about this issue, and you've said before, Chris Hall, that you think that the tax system of Iowa needed some help, some changing.
Yes, I mean, I think there are certain ways that you can improve Iowa's tax code, and you can also make it less complicated or more attractive, whether it's individual tax filers or businesses that are looking to locate in the state. But the difference is, rather than make some of those competitive changes or eliminate things like federal deductibility that complicate our tax rates at the surface level, rather than just make some of those changes that actually reform our tax code, most of the tax policy that was passed is truly just giveaways. You know, my Republican friends have mentioned that there are these safeguards in place to make sure that, you know, Iowa's economy is on track. We would have to have 5% growth in this state for the next several years, and that has not happened. 5% consistently has not happened for this state. It's not likely to happen in the future in order for these tax changes to be realized in 2023. So the things that are front-loaded in this tax change are geared toward the top income earners and the wealthiest 1 or 2%. And those things go into effect no matter what, no matter how Iowa's economy or how our budget looks. But the things that are actually more broadly focused at providing tax relief to middle-income earners and working families don't go into effect until 2023. And that only happens if our budget and our economy grow at a pace that it's not likely to happen. It is a convenient thing to campaign on, but the realities of what this will do to our budget and what it's actually going to do to make Iowa more competitive, I think, are short-sighted. Mm. I would prefer that we're having a conversation about how do we attract more people to this state. And if you're talking about younger 20 and 30-somethings, it's much more about quality of life. It's making sure that they have a good school district, they have a good, lively, and diverse economy, and support entrepreneurs and small business. And to Senator Johnson's point, if you want to attract and retain people in rural Iowa, you also have to make sure that they have a good school district, a good hospital, and a good courthouse. And those are the places where Republicans in the legislature have consistently cut funding and made policies that have endangered those things in rural towns. The last 2 years have been disastrous for some of these small communities where their courthouse is the lifeblood of the community, and That's where all the commerce kind of exists around. And, you know, they've been underfunded along with everybody else in order to pay for these tax cuts that go to the top.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today we're going over what happened at the legislative session that just ended on Saturday. I'm here with Siouxland Representatives Democrat Chris Hall, Democrat Tim Cassina, and Republican Jacob Bossman, State Senator Republican Jim Carlin, and Independent David Johnson. So, you know, I wanted to sort of jump ahead a little bit and talk about the big issue of the last week, aside from the taxes and the budget, the abortion bill that was passed and the governor signed. I just wanted to sort of go around and have a little conversation about what you think about the bill. I know most of the folks here opposed it. Talk about why you opposed it, what you think is going to happen about the lawsuits people are threatening. Explain a little bit about the bill, maybe.
Shall I jump in?
Yeah, we'll go around the table.
Sure. So this is Chris Hall speaking. And, you know, when I spoke about this issue during debate, the points that I tried to make are twofold. Last year, the legislature closed Planned Parenthood clinics and defunded many of them across the state. And that resulted in less access to contraception and less access to birth control. That actually will increase the number of unintended pregnancies. And so if you pass that in tandem with this 6-week abortion ban, the thing that's going to happen is you're going to have more unintended pregnancies and less access to safe and legal termination of a pregnancy. Now, the Supreme Court, not everybody's going to agree with the decision that was reached by the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade, but what it guaranteed was a woman has the right to make a decision for herself, not a decision that is made by politicians, and she is able to make that decision along with her family, her doctor, and her faith. And that is something that was decided by the Supreme Court and frankly has been ruled constitutional. And the part that was most disappointing to me in this whole debate is that so many of my colleagues went ahead with this legislation without even batting an eye at the fact that it's unconstitutional. Each and every single one of us took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, both of the state of Iowa and the United States, and to voluntarily go forward with legislation that is unconstitutional and known to be a vehicle for some greater legal challenge that will cost taxpayers millions of dollars is, I think, unfortunate, as well as the fact that it's just really taking away a woman's right to make her own decisions. All of that is saying, you know, there's passionate voices, well-informed voices on both sides of the issue, but talking about it in a rational way means that we're discussing more how do we reduce the number of abortions, not how do we force them into back alleys and make them dangerous again.
Jim Carlin.
Sure. Well, you know, I've said this each year. We've talked about this issue, and basically what it comes down to me for this is once the government decides who is and who's not a human being, we all lose. And, you know, while they always say we're going to make them safe and rare, it's 60 million children ago. 60 million children who would have had children and grandchildren. Every one of us has a story. Every one of us has kids, I think, in this room. And some of us have grandchildren. And one of the realities is none of those children, none of those grandchildren would exist if our mother had made that decision. One of the things that really disturbs me about Planned Parenthood is its willful targeting of minorities. 79.6% of Planned Parenthood clinics are in minority neighborhoods. 39.6% of abortions in this country are black children when they only represent 12.6% of the population base. You know, if this was a war, that would be considered genocide. And I see this as an active ongoing campaign. Planned Parenthood was created by Margaret Sanger, who was a known eugenist who believed in systematically wiping out percentages of the population base, which included black minorities. And it's unfathomable to me that Democrats could get on board with that. You know, lastly, you know, human beings, I don't think we're ever intended to be defined by the number of weeks of gestation we're at. I mean, it was wrong to judge the value of a human being by their sex, by the color of their skin, by their age or disability. And now, you know, the life of a human being comes down to a number of weeks, which is just incredible to me that we've reached that point.
Could I ask you what you think about the constitutional issue here? Do you think it is unconstitutional?
No.
Do you think there'll be a lawsuit?
You know, I mean, when the law is wrong, it needs to be challenged. You know, whether the Supreme Court of the United States says it's constitutional or not, the Supreme Court of the United States once said black people were 2/3 of a human being. They were wrong then, and they're wrong about this. I think it should be challenged. And, you know, case law in the Supreme Court has been overturned again and again and again. And when something's wrong, it needs to be confronted. This bill has provisions for the life of the mother. This bill has provisions for rape and incest. This bill has provisions for fetal anomalies if a child, you know, has terrible birth defects, you know, where it's not going to have a brain or things like horrible like that. You know, those women are not going to be forced to carry a child with no real life potentiality. So we did the best we could, but it comes down to we want to get on a path where we elevate the value of human beings. And, you know, while, you know, I understand the pressures women face, because women do have it harder than men, and you won't convince me otherwise. I mean, most of my heroes are single moms. The life of a human being and the lives that would come from that human being are worth the sacrifice, and I think men need to step up to the plate culturally and embrace their responsibility as fathers. And I think that's a huge issue in this as well.
Why don't I, I'll get back to you, Jacob. Why don't I get Tim Cassino? What do you think about the abortion bill?
The abortion bill itself, I voted against, no doubt
right.
about it. But what bothered me the most about it is the policy that they got that bill in there with. It had gone through the House. It had gone through the Senate. There wasn't enough votes to pass it. So what they do is they hold budgets hostage till they can get this budget, till they get the six-week bill on there. To me, that's really not governing. That is just basically playing politics with people's lives. The thing about the abortion bill is basically it's ideology versus reality. What are the true cases? How do you really believe compared to how it really affects the people that are out there, such as Planned Parenthood compared to 6 weeks? And I think one thing that I heard a lot on the other side is that if a heartbeat begins life, then heartbeat ends life, it begins life. And I'll tell you, I'm a firefighter, I got a lot of hearts going again. But it did not mean there was life. A heartbeat gives you hope for life, and that's all it gives you.
Jacob.
Yeah, I feel like a lot has been covered. I just want to add that this was an opportunity to respect life, but I think to Representative Hall's point, we do need to understand that a part of that, I believe, is birth control before conception and also human services after birth. But at the same time, we need to understand that this is a life, it has separate DNA, and that it is something that needs to be respected. Also, I just want to add that the Thomas More Society and other organizations have offered to cover the legal bills for this when it inevitably ends up in a court challenge, and I hope that the Attorney General's office will take them up on that.
David Johnson.
I voted for the bill. I would agree with Representative Tim here. Do they call you Representative Tim? That there were a lot of politics played with this. And I just kind of watched over in the Senate. I didn't participate in the debate. I was absolutely shocked by the debate. It was so mechanical. It was surgical. We really didn't know what we were debating on. I don't really believe if you listen to the Senate floor conversation. Here's what I took away from it. Was that if you're pro-life, then you are welcome in the Senate Republican caucus. If you're not, then you might as well find someplace else to land. That was basically stated on the floor. You know, this is a Republican issue. It's a basic core issue. That's not real life. There are Republicans who are not
pro-life. And I'm pro-life. Saying that's not indicative of the House either.
Yeah, there I know. It's not. It's you can't say that. But it was said on the Senate floor. It was said on the Senate floor. I'm trying to be very consistent. I believe that life begins at conception, ends with natural death. That makes me opposed to the death penalty and opposed to what I call doctor-prescribed death or physician-assisted suicide, where we're getting into territory here that we really shouldn't be ruling on. I'm on the board of Iowans for Life, the state board, and we have a meeting Saturday. I'll go down to Des Moines, I think. Have time to get down to Des Moines and attend that meeting, maybe express some of my concerns to other pro-lifers, because we've gone in a direction that the only point is to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's real doubt among legal scholars as to whether the court will even take it up, mm-hmm. the high court, because of the Texas decision. They maybe not want another state case again that maybe similar to the Texas decision.
So can you talk about the Texas decision?
Well, that the arguments that I believe were made there was that the law was so restrictive that just about every Planned Parenthood clinic, every abortion provider in the state would close down, and so deny access. I think that was basically what was going to happen there, and so they've seen a state case about that. But I really didn't care for the discussion. Of course, you know, those opposed to it made their usual legal arguments, and they made them well. But the other underlying thing is that I've come to realize that if you're going to be for life, then you need to be for life. And I believe in education. I believe in protecting the environment. I believe in healthcare. Everybody has to have healthcare access to healthcare. That's the only way we're going to work our way out of this problem. We're not going to work our way out of it as a state or as a country. That's been proven because of the polarization of the two parties. And another reason that I've decided to stop my affiliation with the Republican Party after 18 years, a decision I don't regret at all, and watch and observe and see how the two parties are working. But this, I have been in the Senate when there are Democrats who are pro-life. The bottom line, the Republicans in the Senate did not win over any converts. They won over none. I spoke to this on the Senate floor two nights later. I just said, you didn't win anybody over because you put all the Republicans over here and all the Democrats over here. And politically, I didn't agree with that.
I was just going to say,
Chris Hall.
This is Chris, and I listened to the debate in the House, and I would say, for the most part, I was glad to watch colleagues on both sides of the aisle listening throughout the debate. They were trying to at least hear what the other points of view were. And that, at least I would say, doesn't happen every single debate, but this one it did. And if I were to suggest something to the legislature or future legislatures, Democrats and Republicans alike would all like to reduce the number of abortions that take place. It's a question of how do we make that happen, and how do we do so in a productive and bipartisan manner. One of the things that we need to talk more about is access to contraception and birth control. And I used a little bit of restraint earlier in not quickly responding, but Senator Carlin, the claim that Democrats stand by and support some sort of deep state eugenics idea is absurd. The reason that Planned Parenthood,
the founder of it, was a eugenist. That's not something that can be argued.
I'll finish my thought for a moment here. Okay. The reason that Planned Parenthood clinics and access to contraception and birth control often take place or are oriented toward lower income neighborhoods is because those are the women that have the least ability to afford or access contraception and birth control otherwise. That's the reason for their proximity. And that is something that needs to continue if we want to make sure that fewer abortions take place in the state.
And I would just like to say, honestly,
Tim Cassina.
There's a big difference between pro-life and anti-abortion. I don't think there's anyone at this table who is not pro-life, but we believe that life begins when we believe it begins, but life goes all the way through. We have to make sure that we have the prenatal. We have to make sure they have the Head Start programs. We have to take care of life all the way through until they become adults. And that's being pro-life to me.
The problem with that is the life of a human being takes on subjective value, and it got to the place where we're selling fetal body parts of human beings. And, you know, the thing we need to realize is decisions that are this weighty, they're not, it's not fun to talk about this stuff, but they're not destinations, they're paths. And you go further and further down the path away from your own humanity. And, you know, there's 60 million children whose lives were never realized, whose potentialities, whose benefit we all would have realized and recognized, whether they were our friends, our fathers, our mothers, the people we worked by side with, all the contribution that their humanity would have added to us is lost. And to me, that's tragic.
It's interesting you say that, because in the book Freakonomics, which is a great book, I don't know if you guys read
and
it
TV,
or not.
And a radio show and a TV show.
Yes, I mean, it's just
it's everywhere.
But they did find that after Roe versus Wade, the juvenile delinquency up in Boston dropped tremendously. I mean, so there are both sides to how much you can really contribute.
But there has to be some, political will to this, you know, going forward. Do you think that there's a change in the pendulum swinging here, that people are feeling they need to sort of pull back on supporting abortion in Iowa and in the country? Because it seems like a lot of states have been passing more restrictive bills. Do you think that the sort of general feeling has changed?
I think there have been more and more restrictive bills passed, in part because of the way that state legislatures are oriented right now. We've had probably three out of the last four electoral cycles have gone decidedly in the Republican direction. And right now, Republican control of state houses is at a, I think, century-long high. I don't know that it's been as high as it is right now until you go back into the early 20th century. And so that's fine. You know, when Republicans and Democrats have one-party control of state houses, they tend to act on the issues that, you know, their base identifies as a core value or an issue. And so many states have acted upon that. But it doesn't change the legal casework that exists, and also the fact that the Supreme Court has already come down decidedly on a grown adult woman having the ability to make her own healthcare decisions. You know, not everybody has to agree with the outcome nor the circumstance, in a very hard circumstance that woman might be in. Not everybody has to agree in that, and nobody has to say that they themselves would choose the same. But the fact is, valuing life also includes valuing a grown adult woman in her ability to make those decisions for herself and respect that she is an independent person and somebody with autonomy.
You know, I'm going to jump ahead now, getting on in time a little bit, and talk about Medicaid and how some of the changes to try and deal with the problems of privatized Medicaid, mm-hmm. what was done, trying to make the companies more accountable. Tim, do you think that's going to help in this privatized Medicaid system? So many people say they're having problems getting help and getting that help paid for.
Medicaid is one of the main things that my constituents do talk to me about and the trouble they are having, because undoubtedly the quality of care they had before it was privatized has changed quite dramatically. We had the boards out there that were supposed to watch this in the beginning anyway, and I don't believe they ever met or took care of any action. So saying again we're going to do the same thing over and over again without really having action on it, I don't think so. I think the Medicare privatization has been basically a failure from the beginning. And we'll see what kind of numbers we're going to come up with again this year on the extra funds we have to pay them that go directly from our Medicaid funds that should be going to patients but going to for-profit corporations and insurance companies.
So when will we find out that? When does that, do they know?
That's a Chris question.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Medicaid negotiations were supposed to have started back in January. They still haven't really begun in earnest, and that's frustrating when you're making a budget at the state level, because it's expected this Medicaid contract is going to cost anywhere between $60 and $100 million. But if the legislature isn't sure of that, it puts a lot of question on what our state budget next year will look like, and, you know, do we have a surplus moving forward?
Well, that's been an issue. I mean, for you, you've actually had a lawsuit with, mm-hmm. I believe it was with against the governor and
it was.
Yeah, and what was the outcome of that?
It's still pending.
And okay.
We are actually, we had a hearing that would have been this past Friday, and the date was changed to later in the month. Right now, the lawsuit is still pending. The reason that we filed that legal challenge against Governor Reynolds was because she transferred funds in a way that was not in alignment with state law. She transferred funds in a way that only the legislature had the authority to do. And so she avoided calling us back into a special session and transferred the funds on her own. We are pointing out that the legislature has to do that. And, you know, we took up some changes to state code. I think the majority party watered down the law that Governor Reynolds broke in order to make sure that it wasn't broken retroactively. And so there's a good likelihood that this court case will get dismissed. And if that is the outcome, I'll be perfectly happy with it. We wanted to make the point that you can't break the law no matter who you are and no matter what elected office you hold. You still have to follow the law. Mm-hmm. And it's a fiscally correct thing to do. And if the case gets dismissed because of those updates made to code, so be it. It won't cost the taxpayers a dime, and we'll have made the point that no one gets to be above the law.
Mm. Jim Carlin, what do you think about what's going on, what we were saying before about Medicaid privatization, trying to make companies more accountable? Do you think that will help?
I think there does need to be more accountability of the MCOs that are presently dealing with our people here in Northwest Iowa. I saw firsthand that some of the IHHs weren't getting the funding that they should have gotten. And, you know, the reality is there are going to have to be changes. We're going to be adding two more providers. I don't know if you know that, but it's my hope that by adding those providers, our people will get better services as a result. And Senator Pam Jochim brought up the possibility of treating certain classes of patients separate from the MCOs, which I think needs to be looked at. There are certain classes of patients that, you know, the appropriateness of having those people having to get authorization for basic stuff, I don't think is a good idea. And I think we need to look at maybe having a model that has a private sector and public sector component to it.
You mean some of the people that I've seen, they've had stories on, quite a mm-hmm. few stories in the Des Moines Register, people mm-hmm. that have had permanent disabilities, mm-hmm. Issues, that what
sure.
you're saying?
Yeah. Well, a good example of that is, and I think I talked to you, Chris, last year about, we have a fragile care unit here in Sioux City mm-hmm. that is here in Morningside. They saw their funding drop by 80%. Now, if that facility closes, those people end up in a nursing home, and I don't think they've survived that. I think they would die because they need a higher level of care. It's situations like that where those people cannot go without those resources. And, you know, in an MCO, at least up to this point, and, you know, and bear in mind, the level of spending was at an 18% trajectory upward. That's not sustainable, so you're put in a situation, you know, where you want to try to solve the problem, and we're still trying to get the plane in the air. The plane, you know, we're still trying to solve this problem because mm-hmm. it's expensive and it requires a lot of resources, and healthcare is a difficult thing to cover all your bases with. But I hope we see more accountability. I hope we see more participation and more providers, and I hope we get to a better place than we are right now.
Mm. Well, this is David Johnson. The time is over to be looking at that situation in particular. We need to do it. One reason the state got into so much trouble is that we didn't take people with disabilities, brain injury, those with the most intensive care, and they are owed that. If we're going to really believe that all human life is dignified and needs to be cared for in those situations, the state can do a better job working to ensure that they get the full services that they need. Not an out-of-state MCO whose oversight is not legislators, but their own shareholders. Because those shareholders will take losses for only so long before they start telling their executives, look, you're going to have to cut somebody off of these programs. And the first ones will be the ones we don't see enough of, and that's we don't integrate our communities enough for, although I think we do pretty well up here in Northwest Iowa compared to other areas of the state. is it the time is to make some decisions and not let this languish. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it should be an issue in the gubernatorial debate. Are you going to continue with the MCOs or go back to the government running our Medicaid program? And I'm in that second group, I think. And I voted to terminate the contracts. I've been very public in my comments and very critical of these MCOs. And we've had a lot of providers put in very precarious situations. When it's time to stop and back up the train. People say we can't do that. I don't believe it. I'm a believer. If you really have the will to do something, you can do it. And these people are owed that care.
Well, in Indiana, 10 years ago when I was there, they did this. They did the privatization of Medicaid, and they had a lot of it, the same kinds of issues, and they had to back off of it and do something different. So it seems I think in the end, both Democrats and Republicans sort of agreed on that because they had so many people coming to them and saying, I can't live this way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's what will happen.
It could be.
Yeah.
That we could do that. But I had another thought. But go ahead, Mary.
I was just going to mention a few of the other things that did not pass. And up here, a big issue, the traffic cameras. Mm-hmm. And that got a lot of press, a lot of debate, and a lot of talk. Now, it's important to people who live in communities with these cameras. Some of them feel that they're doing a good job. Some of them feel like they're collecting a lot of money for the city on their making mm-hmm. times hard for them. So let's go around. Tim, what do you think about the traffic cam ban?
I've always been a supporter of the traffic ban, just for the safety aspect of it. I worked on the interstate a lot. I know how dangerous it is. And I think if we can automize packing plants together, we should be able to automize a certain portion of public safety and police work. Having said that, the Senate file that passed out of the House, it was basically what they did last year, was a decent plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was. It put restrictions. You had to justify your camera locations.
It had more local.
It had more.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, you actually had to do it. It got rid of the gotcha cameras, such as if you're going University Avenue and you go into Windsor Heights out there. They got one sitting right there, and you go from 45 to 25 miles an hour that quick. You know, those are gotcha cameras. When they put them in front of the Walmart, those are gotcha cameras. And this bill would have dealt with that. But they were just so darn determined to just ban them completely outright.
There seemed to be no kind of compromise at all on it. So. Is that what you think, Chris? What do you think?
Well, I agree with Tim in that the bill that we considered, it never moved forward, but the bill that we did consider and I voted for would have put more restrictions on the placement of them and make sure that there's good signage and a lot of the right balance between public safety and law enforcement needs, and also making sure that people aren't just having these gotcha camera moments. You know, I joked around with colleagues every once in a while that they need to at least keep the program in place, and you know, I refer to it as our revenue sharing program with South Dakota, but you know, I think if you talk to law enforcement officers, they will say that it does make a difference in their life. It makes a difference in the types of responding calls that they have to make on the interstate. It's something that they can show with data has made a difference in public safety here in Sioux City and other cities. So I side with law enforcement on the issue, but I think there may be some more good guidelines that can be put in place, and I did support them.
Mm. There were some other bills that came up that I really wasn't surprised that they didn't pass. That bill about making a person's immigration status public if they are convicted of a crime, the bill about the so-called the sanctuary cities, we really don't have any of those, I think. What do you think? I mean, do you think there just wasn't political will to pass these kinds of, you know, immigrant sort of based bills? People were concerned mm-hmm. about the safety of immigrants and... Yeah, well, Tim.
Sanctuary cities did pass.
It did pass.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it did?
It did. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
They federalized our local police departments by forcing them to go with ICE, and sanctuary cities did pass.
When did that pass? Was it some time ago?
I would say it was
probably
either
about a month and a half ago.
Sometime late March, early April. Yeah. Maybe.
Well, see, I'm probably not the only one who doesn't know that, too. I hope, anyway.
Yeah.
Let's face it.
This country needs to have a comprehensive policy for immigration. I worked 15 years as a dairy herdsman. I've worked with the dairy industry in Northwest Iowa, South Dakota, of Southwest Minnesota would not be where it is today without immigrant workers. We need those workers. And when I hear Congressman King, for example, say there isn't a job out there that a real American won't take, he is just absolutely wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's one of the polarizing aspects of our politics today that we need to make a change. I voted against this bill. We don't have sanctuary cities. I've been to Storm Lake. It's a vibrant city. Do they have crime? Of course they do. But it's gone down. And it's because of community policing.
The sheriff and the chief
of police for the city both want the state to take their nose out of their business, that they can work with people and make a safe community. And it's like the traffic camera bill. I finally came around to saying, we've taken so much control away from local officials in this General Assembly. That's the 2 years that we met down there, the last 2 years. We've taken so much power away from local officials that I'm going to start, giving them a little bit of credence. They know what they're doing. The Republican mantra used to be, and it's really, a lot of people are writing about this right now. It used to be government is best when it's closest to the people, and that's local control. Mm. But you don't hear them talking about that much anymore.
Yeah. Jim Carlin.
Well, I supported the bill. And one of the reasons why I supported the bill is a significant percentage of crimes, violent crimes, felony crime, is committed by illegal aliens. And law enforcement has to have the ability to track, locate, and identify who these people are. The first duty of government is to protect the citizens. I mean, I had a client who I represented on a case. Her case was resolved. She went to Mexico on a vacation with her kids. She made the mistake of telling some people that she got a sum of money from her case, and her kids were kidnapped the next day, and she was given a note saying, if you don't give us $70,000, we're going to send your kids back to your address in Sioux City in a box. I wish that was just one instance, but as a lawyer, I've heard many instances. And violent crime in Mexico is a very, very significant problem. And one of the realities is you have to know who's coming into your backyard. I mean, if you're a criminal in the U.S., we've got your fingerprints, social security number, we got your cell phone. We're going to be able to track you. Those same abilities are not present otherwise.
Chris?
Final word.
I think we're all chomping at the bit there. These are the misnomers and fear politics that really have gotten too far. You can't just be saying that anybody that comes from another country has a higher tendency to commit violent crimes.
That's not what I'm saying at all.
That was the debate that took place and part of the reason that I did vote against it. Yeah, that along with law enforcement's strong opposition to the bill.
If this was such a great session, why is the governor and the leaders of the Republican caucuses in the House and the Senate not going flying around the state and telling everybody how great it is? That's what has happened before. Wouldn't you agree?
I would.
If they'd be getting out there and saying, boy, did we have a great session. They aren't out there.
The session ended Saturday. Give us a little time.
No, you don't need time.
I'd like to thank Chris Hall and David Johnson and Jim Carlin and Tim Cassina.
And Jacob Bossman as well.
Thank you so much.
He had to leave.
Yeah, he had to take off. But thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. This is Mary Hartnett. You've been listening to The Exchange.